police brutality, and people have lost their sight because of being shot at directly at their eyes with rubber bullets. So when you see him, when he takes advantage of people being in quarantine and not allowed to go out, and he goes there.
We have 5 seconds.
Okay, it's just showing his lack of empathy to this whole social process that we are living.
Ángela Valenzuela, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Climate activist, 350.org organizer, former coordinator with Fridays for Future Chile. As we wrap up our 50th anniversary of Earth Day special in the midst of this raging pandemic, Democracy Now! Is working with as few people as possible, the majority of our team working from home. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Be safe.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Levin & Levine, LLP, attorneys specializing in personal injury law. Levin & Levine offices are located in Southeast Portland and Old Town Sherwood. More information available by phone at 503-946-8708 and online at levinandlevine.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon is one of the states with the lowest capacity to test for COVID-19. Multnomah County now leads in confirmed coronavirus cases in Oregon. And in international news, President Trump is trying to ban immigration to the United States. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 22nd, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. Following an email sent Monday by the White House Coronavirus Task Force to the state capitol, Oregon is reported to be in the bottom four states having the lowest testing capacity for COVID-19. With the ability to test fewer than 30 in 1,000 people a month, Oregon's dismal results paralleled equally poor statistics for Montana, Oklahoma, and Maine. Conversely, states with the highest testing capacity, more than 90 in 1,000, include Vermont, Utah, and Wyoming. Monday's email told governors their leadership is crucial in testing for coronavirus, for rapid and efficient tracking of the virus, as well as providing a tool to help determine when to start lifting stay-at-home orders. The email cited dozens of hospitals, universities, and medical centers that perform testing in Oregon, but only one lab capable of processing several swabs at one time. Tuesday, the Oregon Health Authority announced it is revising guidelines for COVID-19 testing to prioritize at-risk groups and frontline workers. Among these revisions are guidelines urging for increased testing for those living or working in group facilities, as well as underserved and marginalized populations, including racial and ethnic minority groups. As of Tuesday, the OHA released information saying of the roughly 41,000 people tested in Oregon, 2,002 had returned positive results. The governor's office has yet to comment on inquiries regarding the state's testing capacity for the days ahead. Multnomah County has overtaken Washington County as the state's center for COVID-19 cases and fatalities. Over the weekend, Multnomah County confirmed coronavirus cases surpassed 500, compared with Washington County with 408 cases. Since February 28th, when Washington County reported Oregon's first instance of COVID-19, 8 people have died from complications from the virus. The rise in Multnomah County's cases also holds the grim statistic of now having 28 confirmed fatalities from the disease, more than 3 times that of its suburban county cousin. A key factor in the spike of infections stem from 2 Portland-based nursing homes that have had a cluster of infection among populations deemed highly vulnerable to coronavirus. Multnomah County spokeswoman Kate Wilson told Willamette Week, quote, "We have a higher population, so we would expect to be different timing and see more cases if the county follows the same pattern as other jurisdictions. At this time, the total numbers of Oregonians with confirmed cases of COVID-19 are 2,002, with 78 deaths due to the virus reported statewide." Today, President Trump ordered a 60-day ban on immigrants applying for green cards, which allow people to live and work in America permanently. The pause will not apply to temporary workers. It is not clear how Trump's order affects applications already being processed. Around 1 million people were granted green cards last year, mostly through family-based immigration sponsorships by their American spouses. Former Vice President and presumptive Democratic nominee for President Joe Biden responded, saying, quote, "Rather than execute a swift and aggressive effort to ramp up testing, Donald Trump is tweeting incendiary rhetoric about immigrants in hopes he can distract everyone from the core truth. He's moved too slowly to contain this virus, and we are all paying the price for it." The state of Georgia is planning to reopen by the week's end, sparking controversy and concern. With more on the story, here's KBOO's Nat Moon.
Georgia's Governor Brian Kemp said he plans to reopen the state and will allow many non-essential businesses to open their doors on Friday. Those businesses include gyms, bowling alleys, tattoo studios, hair and nail salons, and massage therapists. Many have criticized the move as it poses serious public health risks. CDC Director Jeffrey Copeland said today he sees Georgia's plans as dangerous and fears this will create a second wave of cases. Kemp has argued these risks will be minimized through mandatory screening, enhanced sanitation guidelines, and workspace separation by at least 6 feet. How this will be implemented during massages and in hair and nail salons remains unclear, as physical proximity is normally required with a client in those cases. Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, along with other mayors in the state, was not contacted about this decision before the governor's announcement, and she has said that she is, quote, at a loss as to why Kemp believes it's safe to reopen. Kemp has made it clear that local governments must follow state guidelines that he sets and that, quote, local action cannot be taken that is more or less restrictive. Georgia, the 8th largest state in the union, has one of the highest number of confirmed cases in the region, with more than 800 deaths as of yesterday. It was one of the last states to impose a statewide shelter-in-place, allowing cities and counties to set their own standards. It is also one of the slowest testing states, and data shows that the cases in Georgia have more than doubled in just over 2 weeks, from 7,300 on April 6th to over 20,000 on Tuesday. Though for much of the outbreak, Georgia hasn't collected data showing the race of residents tested for coronavirus, it is known that African Americans make up over 54% of deaths due to the virus in the state. Cuts on public health insurance plans, as well as facility closures, make African Americans twice as likely to lack health insurance when compared to whites in the region. President Trump and Vice President Pence both called the governor on Tuesday night to express support and praise for his plan to reopen by week's end. For KBOO, I'm Nat Moon.
Milwaukee health officials reported at least 7 people who participated in the April elections tested positive for COVID-19. With more on the story, it's Lily Bulkey with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
It's Earth Day, so it's a great time to draw more attention to why it's so important to elect Joe Biden if you care about having a planet for our future. You know, Donald Trump is without a doubt the most anti-environmental president we've ever had. He's rolled back nearly 100 environmental protections.
Craig Oster with the League of Conservation Voters Action Fund says the League endorsed former Vice President Joe Biden this week because voters want leaders who take national and global crises seriously.
I think a lot of people have been rightfully making the connection between our lack of preparation for COVID-19 and our lack of preparation for climate change.
Another endorsement for Biden, the United Auto Workers Union. They picketed GM for over a month last year. Biden needs $187 million to catch up to President Donald Trump. Biden's campaign announced $46.7 million raised in March, his best month so far. An individual can donate up to $2,800 to a candidate before and then again after the party conventions. The Democratic National Convention's delay until August leads to less time for general election fundraising, says journalism professor Robert Yoon at the University of Michigan.
But in the big scheme of things, there's such a fundraising disparity between Trump and Biden that month might not make as big a difference in terms of reducing that disparity, but at least on a day-to-day basis, it might stretch their dollars out.
It's not clear what form the convention will take. It's scheduled to be in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where the nation just tested in-person voting. City health officials report at least 7 locals who stood in line or worked the polls have tested positive for COVID-19. Only 5 of the usual 180 polling sites were open across the whole city, causing long lines. Milwaukee is almost 40% Black. Kylie Scales, managing director of Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation, says across the state, her community waited for hours to send a message.
It says a lot about the loyalty of the Black voter. It says a lot about the responsibility that candidates have to those voters who took those risks and stood on line in the middle of a global pandemic, where their health was at risk.
30% of COVID-19 patients are Black, even though African Americans make up just 13% of the population overall. Yesterday, on the heels of a federal judge ordering ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, to consider releasing all detainees at high risk for the virus, President Trump announced an executive order to temporarily halt all immigration to the U.S.
It's a combination of extreme power on top and a diminished sense of power on the bottom for the immigrants themselves. And so it's sort of a perfect storm of this kind of authoritarianism that Trump has been maintaining.
Mount Holyoke College professor David Hernandez says the president relies on executive orders to implement immigration policy far more than any other president has, undermining Congress's ability to make coherent reform. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
42% of Oregon's small business payrolls were covered by the federal Paycheck Protection Program last week, the third lowest rate among the states. The $350 billion Paycheck Protection Program, administered by the Small Business Association, was designed to give companies with up to 500 employees the equivalent of a 2.5 months of payroll in forgivable loans. The top three states, Nebraska, North Dakota, and Kansas, whose residents are overwhelmingly Trump supporters, got an average of 79.4% of their small business payrolls covered, while the bottom three, Oregon, New York, and California, all largely critical of Trump, got an average of 40%. Senator Ron Wyden said, quote, "When COVID-19 has forced small businesses throughout Oregon into a daily battle to make payroll, it's imperative that relief Congress passed to help get distributed fairly without any partisan thumb on the scale." Northern Arapaho Business Council Chairperson Lee Spoonhunter urges citizens to follow COVID-19 orders following deaths in the community. With that story and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Northern Arapaho tribe lost 4 of its members to COVID-19 this week, Wyoming Public Radio Savannah Marr reports.
Chairman Lee Spoonhunter of the Northern Arapaho Business Council addressed the tribe Tuesday morning on a live stream. He said 2 tribal elders and 2 adults died on Monday. 3 were members of the same immediate family.
These tribal members were our family members who were dearly loved. But because of the restriction put in place, we cannot mourn together as a family or tribe.
There's a strict stay-at-home order on the Wind River Reservation, which has at least 24 confirmed cases of COVID-19. Chairman Spoon-Hunter urged tribal members, especially young people, to follow the order.
Many of you continue to discard the safety of our elders. Your grandparents love you unconditionally and depend on the love you have for them to conduct yourself and behave in a proper way.
Spoon-Hunter said the reservation needs to flatten its curve, or spring and summer ceremonies may need to be canceled. The news triples Wyoming's confirmed COVID-19-related deaths, bringing that number up to 6. For National Native News, I'm Savannah Marr.
The top two leaders of the Navajo Nation are out of self-isolation Wednesday, showing no COVID-19 symptoms. President Jonathan Nez and Vice President Myron Leiser were in self-isolation for 2 weeks after coming into close contact with a first responder who tested positive for COVID-19. During a virtual town hall Tuesday, they urged residents to continue to follow emergency health orders. As Navajo health officials this week report, there appears to be a flattening of the curve. President Jonathan Nez.
The data and the information and what you all are doing at home, it's working. Because the quote that I'm going to use off the report says, there does appear to be a flattening of the Navajo Nation epi curve. So thank you so much for everyone out there abiding by the stay-at-home order. Remember, we're still in the stay-at-home order all the time, 24/7. Only one person should be getting essentials.
Orders include shelter in place, nightly curfews, 57-hour weekend curfews, and requiring masks in public. As of Tuesday, there were more than 1,200 positive cases for the Navajo Nation, with nearly 50 deaths related to the coronavirus. Two Oklahoma tribes signed new gaming compacts with the state Tuesday, while other tribes continue their fight in court. Leaders of the Oto Missouri and Comanche tribes joined state leaders in a signing ceremony. Oto Missouri Tribal Chairman John Shotton.
At a time when so much is uncertain with this COVID-19 situation, we've negotiated a new compact to provide stability for the Oto Missouri tribes featuring gaming for our tribe, our employees, our patrons, our vendors, and our banking partners. And we know that when things return to normal and we're able to open our casinos again, we're going to have a very stable foundation.
More than 30 tribes have been in a gaming dispute with Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt for months. The tribes say their compacts automatically renewed January 1st, 2020. The governor disagrees, saying they expired and is seeking to renegotiate with higher fees. The Chickasaw, Choctaw, and Cherokee Nations filed a federal lawsuit late last year. In response to Tuesday's signing ceremony, Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. stated on social media it does not change their course of action. Stitt says the state will continue to negotiate with tribes. Court activity has been delayed until the end of May. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on a protective clothing collective for medical and houseless workers. At 5:45, stick around to hear news from the BOO, your news inside KBOO. At 6, it's the Underground, then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 47. Tomorrow's weather will be mostly cloudy with a high of 65. Today in history, it's Earth Day. First celebrated in 1970, this special day now includes events in more than 190 countries. Earth Day was proposed after a massive oil spill in 1969 that killed tens of thousands of animals in Santa Barbara, California. Earth Day usually includes many demonstrations and group meetups, but this year, the 50th anniversary, of course, marks the first digital Earth Day ever. The quote of the day is from Margaret Mead, an anthropologist and leading feminist in the 1960s and 70s. She said, quote, "Never doubt that a group of small, thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." Of 19 supergiant Saudi oil tankers, each capable of holding 2 million barrels of oil, is reportedly en route to the U.S., and President Trump might not let them in. The tankers are carrying 7 times more Saudi oil than the kingdom usually ships to the U.S. Gulf Coast, raising concerns about an oversupply, further lowering prices. For the first time in history, oil prices turned negative. Suppliers were paying customers to take the oil, as many storage facilities are full due to increased supply and sharply decreased demand. The Trump administration officials are considering either steep tariffs on oil imports or a block on incoming tankers to help domestic oil producers. Last week, the president said he planned to use government funds to buy domestic crude, a plan environmentalists are calling yet another bailout. New cases in California are bringing up questions of when and how coronavirus entered the United States. With more on the story, here's KBOO's Nat Moon.
An autopsy in Santa Clara County, California, has uncovered the earliest known deaths from coronavirus in the United States, one of which was on February 6th of this year. The other death was on February 17th. The CDC confirmed that autopsies of both people who died in their homes showed the individuals were infected with COVID-19. These new deaths suggest that the coronavirus was likely spreading in California much earlier than previously thought. As the county's chief medical officer, Dr. Sarah Cody, said in an interview, quote, "Each one of those deaths is probably the tip of an iceberg of unknown size." Neither of the individuals who died in February had any known travel history that would have exposed them to the virus. It is presumed they contracted the virus in the community. Authorities had initially identified a series of coronavirus cases from individuals who had recently traveled in January, but community spread of the virus wasn't identified until several weeks after that. The lag time will likely be attributed to the lack of testing available in the United States and the strict guidelines that allow individuals to actually get tested. Reporting for KBOO, I'm Nat Moon.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler is under fire for violating campaign finance disclosure rules in a ruling made on Tuesday. The city auditor's office found Wheeler non-compliant in following new city election rules by not properly disclosing large campaign contributions on his re-election website. Under these rules, campaign websites are required to disclose major contributions and other financial information. Wheeler's campaign failed to do so on his website, as well as his Facebook re-election page and on his Twitter account. With the newly enacted guidelines, candidates are required to explicitly list the top 5 donors who have given more than $1,000 toward campaign communications. Elections officer Deborah Scrogan cited 3 violations and ordered Wheeler's campaign website updated. She also mandated that they identify the contributors, who were credited simply as friends of Ted Wheeler by midnight Tuesday. The ruling came in response to a complaint filed on March 20th by Ronald Buell, a member of the political action committee Honest Elections Oregon, which has pushed for increased campaign financial transparency. Wheeler initially had until May 5th to update campaign contribution information or face fines upwards of $10,000. Buell said prior to Tuesday's ruling, the extended date to comply was, quote, ridiculous, in a letter to Scrogan, who responded that the date was acknowledging the complexity of the newly adopted regulations, as well as delays from disruptions caused by the ongoing COVID-19 crisis. In an email following the ruling, Wheeler's campaign manager, Amy Rathfelder, said the campaign was grateful for the city's clarification of the rules and will correct the violations. Oregon's primary is slated for May 19th, with 3 candidates challenging Wheeler this year, Sarah Iannarone, Teresa Rayford, and Ozzie Gonzalez. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael keeps looking for silver linings.
Oil is selling for negative numbers. They'll pay you to take it away. Fuel use by people and industries is way down, so the world's air quality is improving. Since many people are staying home, sea turtles can lay eggs on beaches, coyotes freely roam city streets. Happy Earth Day. Maybe the coronavirus is a loud and close enough warning shot that crucial environmental actions will follow, but I doubt it. Trump's using the pandemic as a cover to cancel more protection laws. Most of the relief money for small businesses went in big chunks to companies on the stock market. Trump tweets about the invisible enemy and the need to close the borders. Next, he won't allow us to leave. Supplies of ventilators, PPE, and test kits continue to be fatally inadequate, yet DT and allies want to reopen businesses because, due to some deep-seated rapacity where their soul should be, they need many more of us sick and dead. How twisted, arrogant, or non-human can one be to destroy this planet we can't live without? For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
McManaman's announced Tuesday its pubs are reopening Friday for takeout orders after closing last month due to executive orders from Governor Kate Brown. The iconic Portland-based chain laid off roughly 3,000 employees from its bars, restaurants, and hotels as COVID-19 health concerns shut down many businesses throughout the state. The company has said it is unclear at this time how many employees will be back to work staffing the reopened pubs. McManaman's posted on its Facebook page they will continue to adhere to social distancing recommendations and will follow other safety and sanitation guidelines during the ongoing pandemic as they transition into a soft reopening. Customers will be able to call in their orders, and many pubs will be set up for delivery services through Postmates and DoorDash. Takeout menus will include family-sized meals for four and include popular signature items such as McManaman's tater tots, beer, and wine will also be available to go. For the first time, Earth Day has gone digital. With more on the story, here's Dr. Anthony Leisowitz with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. 18-year-old Shia Bastida grew up in a small town outside Mexico City, where she saw the effects of both drought and flooding. Then, when she was 13, she moved to New York City and learned about the damage Hurricane Sandy caused there. She realized global warming affects communities all around the world and felt driven to do something about it.
When I saw the first global strike being called, I organized my school and I got 600 kids to walk out with me. I thought that two kids would walk out with me.
She says it helped her realize how many other young people are worried and ready to act. Since then, she's helped organize weekly youth climate strikes across the city. Now, because of the coronavirus, youth activists have taken their actions online. A long-planned Earth Day strike is being held digitally, with online teach-ins, virtual gatherings, and social media campaigns. Whether young people are on the streets or in cyberspace, Bastida says they bring a sense of energy and optimism to the climate movement.
Not in a way in which you are naive about the situation we are in, but just truly believing that when we come together, we can change the world.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
And now we hear from Labor History in Two, Rick Smith's daily reminder of labor's continuing struggle throughout the years. Today he's talking about one of the worst mining disasters that took place in Virginia in 1938.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1938. That was the day the Keene Mountain coal mine exploded near Grundy, Virginia. Described as a flame-belching volcano, the explosion killed 45 and injured three more. It is considered one of the worst mining disasters in the history of Virginia. One surviving miner described the scene saying, quote, "I saw coal-carrying cars, motors, slate, and timbers spouted as if from a cannon." The state mine inspector determined the miners had been killed instantly. The mine had just opened the year before and produced 40 railroad cars of coal a day. But the mine was also owned by the Red Jacket Coal Company. In Mingo County, West Virginia, years earlier, Red Jacket had been a key player in keeping the UMWA out, making its employees sign yellow dog contracts and winning injunctions against union organizing. As a member of the Williamson Coal Operators Association, Red Jacket contributed to the hostile anti-union environment that created the conditions for the Matewan Massacre and the Battle of Blair Mountain in the early 20s. They called in Baldwin Phelps detectives to start evicting Matewan strikers from company housing. In the aftermath of the 1938 explosion, new mine safety regulations were demanded. The inspectors were finally given the legal right to conduct inspections over the protest of mine owners in 1941. However, there was no power to enforce the new regulations. The Phipps family commemorated the disaster in its 1965 song, Red Jacket Mine Explosion.
Coming under the ground, what could have brought such disturbance? Oh, what could have caused such a fright?
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Over 11,000 sick and dead birds have been reported in Germany in the last 2 weeks. Most of the diseased birds are blue tits, which are common throughout Europe. Laboratory test results on the dead birds have found a bacterial infection known to cause pneumonia in these birds. There are no reports of the bacteria affecting any animals other than birds. According to the German conservation group NABU, symptoms of the diseased birds include breathing problems, ignoring food, and making no attempt to fly away when approached by people. The group advises people to stop feeding or providing drinks to birds to reduce the risk of spreading that disease further. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 22nd, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at our brand new number, 971-245-2158. You can also text us there. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bulkey, Antonia Gonzalez, Dr. Anthony Leiswitz, and Rick Smith. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website, kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 8, it's Voices from the Edge, progressive talk radio from a grassroots perspective. At 9, it's Press Watch with the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Between the Covers. And tomorrow, host Ken Jones talks with Julia Stoops about her novel, Parts Per Million. At 11:30, it's Words and Pictures with conversations from pioneering artists and animators. All of these KBOO programs are made possible with support from our listeners. If you'd like to support us, go to kboo.fm/give, or you can use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for We Are All in This Together with Suzanne LeGrand, and after that, news from the Boo. Thanks for listening.
And today on We Are All in This Together, I am speaking with Judy Burke, who is a freelance writer and has organized a group of strangers in Northeast Portland to design and make protective gowns, both for medical workers and also for people who are working with the homeless. So, could you tell us a little bit about this project of making protective gowns for people who are on the front lines?
Sure. It started with my becoming sick early on, March 11th. I had a sore throat, and then I developed a mild version of COVID with all the symptoms, and so did my family, and we quarantined. I spoke with my doctor's office every day to find out if testing was being expanded, and it wasn't. But that's how I learned that they had a PPE shortage there. My son, who is in high school as a maker, has a 3D printer, was looking at printing masks, but discovered that on his 3D printer takes a long time. He went into the Dollar Tree store to look for large pieces of plastic that he could make some other model with. And he came home with a shower curtain liner that was made out of Teva, which is a non-toxic plastic that's impermeable, waterproof. We had the idea of using them to make gowns, since masks aren't the only thing that are needed. And so I made a prototype gown just with two armholes and ties in the back out of a shower curtain liner, sleeves out of the shower curtain itself. It was not very good, and I knew I needed help. So I got on our next door group. We have a very active next door group in our neighborhoods in Northeast, and I asked for help with people who would be willing to sew, who had scissors or had sewing machines, or who would be willing to organize or run for supplies. And I got an incredible response right away. Basically, this turned into a group of about 10 people that we didn't know each other at all, but included two retired nurses who sew, and a rabbi, and several students, someone who works at Bonneville Power Administration. One of the people who responded offered her porch as a drop-off point, which I needed because I was quarantined and I couldn't do any of this work myself, but I could organize and I could also work on the design and the instructions and do it all online. And so we got the group together. We got the two retired nurses on the phone who looked at my awful design and came up with a better design and started making those. And then my husband got quite sick, sicker than me, and started having chest pains, and we both had the cough. But finally, after 10 days, he was told to come in and take a test. And then, because I lived with him, I was told to also take a test. So I went through Broadway Medical Clinic's new drive-through testing center and took my test, and meanwhile, waiting for the flu test results to come back, because they give you that first, and it takes 15 minutes, I asked the nurse who had given it to me how I could reach somebody who was the nurse manager or higher so I could talk to them about our gowns. And she said, well, that would be me. The head of quality at Broadway Medical Clinic was doing the testing. She said that they were very short, and it sounded like a very good idea. She also said they were working on a solution with a laundromat so that they could use fabric gowns that would be laundered, but that it hadn't come through yet, and they were quite nervous. I couldn't physically do any of it because I had symptoms. I couldn't go to Dollar Tree and get the supplies. I couldn't drop them off at the porch, and I couldn't sew them because I would contaminate them. But what I could do was organize everyone online, figure out who needed to do what, how many people had scissors and could cut out sleeves and tunics, and how many people had sewing machines and could sew them into the completed gowns. I just needed someone's porch and a bunch of boxes so that people would have a place, safe place to drop and drop off and pick everything up. And then we delivered our first batch of 18 gowns to them. And then they were able to secure a solution through the laundromat. Meanwhile, we learned that one of the women in the group had a contact at Central City Concern who said that they had nothing and their outreach workers were going out and dealing with the most vulnerable people on the streets, and they had nothing to protect them. So they're on the front lines also, but had no access to personal protective equipment. And so our next batch went to them of 22, and then I just delivered 10 to a group called Free Hot Soup, which is an ad hoc group of people that serve meals to the homeless at Directorate Park and have been doing that for over a year. And they're still serving food, and they're handing out bags with peanut butter and jelly. And people really need food, and they have no way to get it. But these workers also had no protection, and so we delivered gowns to them.
Since you started doing this with this group of people, what have you learned about the need for PPE in, say, Portland?
The medical community here is getting on top of this. I think that they are finding some solutions, and they also are not as open to anything homemade as they were, say, 10 days ago. So I think that the medical community is in a little bit better shape, but the community of people that do outreach to the homeless is not in better shape. I've heard about the need at places like Central City Concern, and also Transition Projects is another one that I've heard is in really dire need. And so we're going to continue our efforts with that. My perspective has changed a bit. At first, because we've been doing this almost 2 weeks now, at first I was worried that we would quickly run out of shower curtain liners and shower curtains at Dollar Tree stores, because we were basically, our organizers were going in and with donated money and buying up as many as they could. And at the same time, we were making the instructions better and had redesigned the gown to be better and smaller. And then finally, I started getting requests for the instructions, and I was asking group members whether we should just publish them online and get them out if we were ready for that. And there's a rabbi in the group, and I asked what he thought, and he said, "This isn't ours. It's not our problem. This is everybody's problem to solve together." We decided to go public, but I needed to finalize the instructions, and so I stopped sewing the gowns myself and just worked on the instruction set and illustrations and testing it and having other people test it until it was perfect. And I discovered through Facebook that there are all kinds of new ad hoc COVID-19 maker groups that are international, and realized it would be very simple to distribute this worldwide to other people who wanted to make gowns. Once it was ready, it only took about 20 minutes for me to upload the file to a whole bunch of different groups all around the world. So now there's an instruction set, and it includes a picture of me without my head, just my body wearing a gown. The instructions are out there, and people have been asking for them and downloading them. So now hopefully gowns are being made all over the world. They're very simple to make, just require a straight line on a sewing machine and not any more skill than that.
What have you learned in this couple of weeks since you started this project? Has anything surprised you?
I wouldn't say I was surprised, because I've already known this about people, but when I put the request out on Nextdoor, people stepped up. There's so many people who are good at heart, who want to help, and who will just jump in when needed. A lot of the people who responded weren't sure they could do it, but were willing to, and if they couldn't do it, they were willing to donate money, or they were willing to get supplies, or to drop things off on the porch, or to organize. People have a wellspring that can be tapped in times like this, and I was very happy to see that response.
What do you hope might come out of this situation?
I've been really moved by the heart that people show, both at the local level and around the world. that even when our leaders are demonstrating complete incompetence in so many regards with this crisis, there are communities of people both locally and around the world that are creative, resourceful, energetic, and are willing to tackle this problem. Everyone from high-tech 3D printer groups around the world to people with a pair of scissors who are willing to get a cheap shower curtain and make it into something useful. Communities, really meaningful communities, can spring up under the most unlikely circumstances. I feel very close to these people who I've never actually been able to see more than a glimpse of from my car. Experiences like this can bring out the best in people and also create communities, and we're planning to have one big party at a local restaurant as soon as we're all cleared to do so.
I've been talking today with Judy Burke, who is a freelance writer and also has organized a group of people in Northeast Portland to make and distribute protective clothing, both to medical workers and also people who are working with the homeless. I am Suzanne LeGrand, and this is We Are All in This Together for KBOO Community Radio News, 90.7 FM in Portland.